This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The kids are going to be really upset if they lose TikTok over national security concerns. But you know who's going to miss WeChat the most? American businesses. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, September 18th. Good to have you with us, and congratulations on making it through yet another week in this emotional and economic roller coaster we call normal. First, a wrap-up of the big economic stories of the week, and let's just dive on in, shall we? Anna Swanson is with the New York Times. Catherine Rempel is at the Washington Post. Hey, you two.
Hey, Molly.
Hey there.
So let's actually start. You heard at the top this conversation about TikTok and WeChat. What do we think are the potential ripple effects, culturally, economically, and otherwise, of something like this? I'll start with you, Anna. I'm going to pick
Sure. Yeah, of course. Of course. I've been writing about this today. So this is an unprecedented ban on some really popular services. And so I think the potential ripple effects are really interesting. First of all, these apps will, the government isn't going to go out and police people and make them delete the apps from their phones, but these apps will start to degrade for users here in the United States. Their functionality will get weaker. So that will affect people's use. There's questions about whether there will be Chinese retaliation. China already blocks a lot of American services like Twitter and Facebook, but there are a lot of other things that the Chinese government could do to penalize American companies. I think it raises questions about whether we'll see more bans like this on other Chinese companies, Alibaba, for example. And then lastly, just taking a big picture view, we seem to be headed toward a situation in which what we think of as the global internet is breaking down into a lot of different internets with different rules for the US, for China, for Europe. And for a long time, we've thought about the internet breaking down borders and connecting people around the world. But actually now it kind of seems to be fracturing, both due to nationalism and security fears.
Yeah, Catherine, I think that's, moving on from just these two apps in this conversation, this is a big precedent to set. In some ways, it's the U.S. government taking a stance very similar to the Chinese government, right? Saying these are the kinds of businesses that will be allowed to operate here. How does that look for the global economy? Yeah.
Well, there are a number of complications that could arise from this, right? I mean, you have First Amendment legal challenges already arising here within the United States. You have the risk of businesses not being able to conduct their normal operations wherever they are. And so businesses already complain, obviously, about having to deal with different regulatory regimes once they cross borders, even if they are a company that, like a digital company, for example, that does not operate strictly within the physical borders of any one country. This is going to complicate their lives much more. And you could imagine that, as Anna points out, there could be further retaliation that just adds even more uncertainty for businesses as they're trying to figure out how to operate within China, within the United States, stay on the right side of the law, avoid offending any minder, as it might turn out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that said, Anna, are these concerns real? Even if the data collection part is overblown, there's no question that WeChat and TikTok in some ways can represent the viewpoint of the Chinese government, right?
Yeah, I think when it comes to data collection, you know, cybersecurity experts are kind of debating how much of a risk there is. I mean, it certainly does, you know, could give the Chinese government access to some data. And Chinese laws require that, you know, Chinese individuals and Chinese companies submit that data to the Chinese government if asked. So part of the issue is Chinese laws on that subject. But there are a lot of mobile services that collect a lot of data, you know, about Americans that, you know, we haven't maybe thought about systematically. The other argument here, though, is about the Chinese government's ability to censor and put out propaganda. And I think when you look at WeChat, it is clear that it is a conduit for censorship and for propaganda. It's also, you know, a vitally important communication system for the global Chinese diaspora, but the Chinese government definitely has a say in shaping what reality looks like on that platform.
Right. We'll have more on WeChat actually and business in just a minute. With about 30 seconds left, Catherine, I want to ask you about the Fed and this plan to keep interest rates basically where they are until 2023. Why do you think the Fed is the only government agency that really seems to be acknowledging how long a road this is going to be?
Well, I think it turns out that when you have when you have an institution that is not subject to short-term political incentives, such as an election, it may mean that the people who work at that institution are able to think more long-term and to be more honest about what the challenges that lie ahead actually are, not just in the coming months, but in the coming years. So in a sense, insulating the Federal Reserve, you know, the world's premier economic policymaking body, from those kinds of political constraints may allow them to not only maintain credibility in terms of their forecasts, but also in terms of their actual policy commitments. So I think that's potential way to explain why they have somewhat of a darker view and maybe a longer term view than our other institutions.
Anna Swanson with the New York Times, Catherine Rempel from the Washington Post. Thanks so much, you two.
Thanks, Molly.
On Wall Street today, a little more hard truth here. You might want to sit down for this, but it turns out that tech stocks also go down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So a little more on these bans of Chinese companies. TikTok obviously gets the most attention. WeChat, though, will be banned effective Sunday. That is a big deal. WeChat has about a billion monthly users worldwide. It's a staple, as in fact you just heard, of the Chinese-American community here in the U.S. Millions of people use it to stay in touch and also to buy stuff. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
Starting Sunday, users in the U.S. will no longer be able to download or update TikTok and WeChat. Also, they won't be able to make payments through WeChat, which could be a big deal to many of the millions of WeChat users in America who use the platform to send money back to China. Professor Dan Wang teaches at Columbia Business School.
WeChat Pay is the world's largest payments platform. This is so ubiquitous that if you're a visitor to China and you don't have a WeChat account, it is very difficult to pay for anything.
So for millions in America, WeChat is the way to buy goods and send money to China. Professor Ari Lightman from Carnegie Mellon says now those people will
have to find complete alternate ways associated with receiving remuneration or paying various different things, which is going to be very problematic and troublesome.
William Wong in North Carolina is already trying to figure it out. He sends his family in China money for bills and goods through WeChat.
If sometimes we need to buy something from China to get it shipped here, we'll use WeChat to pay either our friends or family to make that purchase for us.
Wong says the ban will be a headache, but he's more worried about how it will affect his parents. WeChat is the way they stay in touch with family back in China.
My concern is for my parents that they cannot talk to their family or my extended family, I guess, anymore if WeChat is banned. It's just cruel.
Wong says he hasn't yet told them about the WeChat ban. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
So you know about futures. You make a deal to buy or sell something at a certain price on October 1st or December 1st. There are futures for gold, crude oil, currencies, hogs, and now water. There's a new product that lets water users in California lock in prices for H2O. Commercial users. The idea is to let, you know, farmers get access to water at predictable prices. But as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, how will this actually work?
To state the obvious, it's just not that easy to transact in water. It's not a block of gold or even a barrel of oil. Economist David Zetlin is the author of Living with Water Scarcity.
If you want to ship that water somewhere, you're going to spend way more money shipping it than the water is actually worth. It's going to be a very, very narrow list of buyers and sellers because they have to be local to the water.
But a small percent of California farmers do buy and sell. And this new futures product would let a farmer buy a year's worth of water at a price already locked in. Right now, it's about $500 for 326,000 gallons. Tim McCourt is managing director at the CME Group, which is launching the water futures.
With already 2 billion people living in high-stress water areas, there's a clear demand for the ability to manage price risks associated with water.
Ideally, a price on water reflecting its scarcity would prompt users to conserve it and sell any surplus for profit. But with water, selling is often not allowed because of complex rights issues, says Peter Glick at the Pacific Institute think tank.
There are fewer places in California where water can be transferred legally.
So he thinks the impact of the California water futures will be small. What is likely is the futures price will pinball up and down. Ellen Hanek is with the Public Policy Institute of California.
We have a very volatile precipitation pattern. It can be dry or wet in any given year, and demand is tighter.
For investors, these futures are a new way to bet on a fast-changing climate. If you saw the movie The Big Short about the 2008 financial crisis, recall one investor who saw it coming saying he's now focused on trading water. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the show must go on and the show will go on.
Will it though? No, yeah, it will. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, I mean, it's relaxing, right? Ended the day down 244 points, 0.8% to close at 27,657. I mean, the music, not the numbers. The NASDAQ fell 116 points, 1% to finish at 10,793. And the S&P 500 gave back 37 points, 1.1% to finish at 3319. For the week, the Dow was down less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ dipped a little over 0.5%. The S&P 500 fell just shy of 0.2%. And as we head into the weekend, let's look at gas prices. A gallon of regular, about $2.18 on average, according to AAA. Bonds fell slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note is 0.69%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Millions of kids are starting school remotely this month. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced just yesterday that school there won't reopen on Monday. Yeah, that was short notice. The city will be phasing kids into classrooms over the next few weeks. And each week on Marketplace Tech, we've been talking about the challenges of remote schooling. One of the biggest is broadband internet access. Cities and school districts are distributing thousands of Wi-Fi hotspots in homes and public places, and in some ways, creating lots of new internet broadband infrastructure on the fly. Christopher Mitchell is director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative at the nonprofit Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Molly.
All right. So for those who don't know, I'm sure most do, but like, what does a hotspot do for people? Why are we seeing school districts and cities and even private companies set these up?
A wireless hotspot is something that will basically give internet access, often a pretty decent signal, for about 300 feet around it. And so we're seeing companies and nonprofit organizations and all kinds of entities setting them up, often in parking lots, so that people can access the internet when they don't have home internet access.
And then some cities are, like Chattanooga and Chicago, are providing broadband straight to individual homes. I guess I wonder, you know, will there be any going back from broadband as a utility in this way once everybody's got some version of it?
It's interesting because I was just looking at an argument in a city council in which they were arguing, well, we're going to install these hotspots. Should we take them down at some point? Do we want to say we're only going to do it for 2 years? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they decided that they should leave them up indefinitely. And I feel like at this point, it's hard to imagine where it'll be acceptable policy to not have kids have home internet access, in part because I think we're going to see different things like, for instance, if it's COVID-19 may pop up again in certain school districts and they'll have to go offline or actually go online for a month. So I don't think there's any going back, no.
ISPs have deployed hotspots, private companies have, but a lot of school districts are also really having to pick up the slack here. Like, what does it say that we're asking school districts to provide internet access to their students so that they can stay online and keep learning?
Yes. And to give an example, it's everything from schools that are making Wi-Fi available in the parking lots to schools that are spending tens of millions of dollars, perhaps in a partnership with the city or a private provider, to build a private wireless network just for students that tens of thousands of students will access. So schools are going to great lengths. And I feel like it's almost the norm for schools where we have societal problems like kids not getting enough to eat, and the schools kind of step up. I certainly feel like we can learn something from schools and the can-do attitudes we've seen in a lot of places.
What about the money? Like, we know that, you know, city and state revenues are taking a huge hit as a result of the pandemic, and that almost always results in cuts to education budgets. Like, how does this trickle down when schools are in that position, districts are in that position to have to spend tens of million dollars on infrastructure?
Well, some of this is definitely coming out of the CARES Act, which was federal legislation that put money toward different activities that would benefit people who have been harmed by COVID-19 or trying to just blunt the impact. So a lot of the money that we've seen going into these different investments has been from that. And I don't know where the next tranche of money is going to come from. Local governments and states have real budget shortfalls they're worried about. Mm-hmm. But the federal government, I mean, it's one of the reasons we trust the federal government is that it's supposed to be countercyclical. It's supposed to spend money when no one else can, and often in smart investments. And we are not seeing that right now.
If schools hadn't gone remote, do you think we would have seen this push for expanded access?
I think we would have over time. I think it accelerated things. I mean, you know, some of these schools already had these plans because this was an issue. I mean, there's school districts in which half of the kids did not have home internet access. And it's led to significant racial inequity, where you certainly have kids that tend to be more people of color who'd have less home internet access. And so then they have less opportunity to learn, already often facing more challenging circumstances. And so this was a big deal already, but it just became intolerable when you couldn't do any schoolwork rather than just not being able to do your homework.
Christopher Mitchell is the director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Molly.
The pandemic has been nothing short of a disaster for, well, so many things, really, not least of which is cultural institutions like art museums. Many are facing severe budget shortfalls. New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art could face a deficit of over $100 million this year. Some smaller museums might have to close permanently. Marketplace's Erica Barris looked into what art museums may have to do to survive.
Next month, the Brooklyn Museum will sell 12 pieces from its permanent collection. Museums regularly sell art to acquire other art, but selling art for financial reasons? That's long been a huge no-no, says NYU finance professor David Yermak.
The rationale for that was really to just keep the curators from selling off the collection to overpay themselves and to personally consume the value of the collection.
But then the pandemic happened, says Michael O'Hare, a professor at UC Berkeley, and
people have stopped coming and stopped paying admission.
That means museums will be facing budget shortfalls, says Brent Benjamin, president of the Association of Art Museum Directors.
Anywhere from tens to hundreds of millions of dollars. So really a significant financial impact.
art museums are in a unique position to ride out the pandemic crisis. Unlike zoos or natural history museums, says Wayne State University art historian Jeffrey Apt.
They have assets that can be translated into cash for fairly quickly and fairly efficiently.
And most major art museums have a surplus of art, says NYU's David Yermak. He estimates 5 paintings in storage for everyone on display.
If they sold these off, not only could they improve their own financial positions, but you could really find other places for the art to be displayed. The smaller museums could build their own collections.
And if it came to it, those smaller museums, too, could sell that art. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
More virus fallout in the arts, this time in Mexico. Before the pandemic, the theater industry in Mexico was growing steadily, becoming Latin America's Broadway and a hub for many U.S. productions. But now the industry and its workers have seen a big decline in jobs, with only limited ways to retool production safely. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
This is what the main song from one of the biggest Broadway musicals performed in Mexico City sounded like earlier this year. Jesus Christ Superstar, or Jesucristo Superestrella in Spanish, was one of the most successful plays in Mexico until the pandemic struck.
It's become an absolute nightmare because priorities do not include us.
That's Guillermo Vigers, vice president of the Mexican Society of Theater Producers.
20 million seats we haven't sold. 10,000 families depend directly on what they earn from the theater.
Viger says the Mexican theater industry has lost about $1 billion since theaters closed in early March, even before the official lockdown. The producer says the government hasn't provided any relief, not even tax discounts. Instead, authorities suggested producing plays with 3 actors or fewer and using open amphitheaters and masks like the Greeks did in the past.
I don't want to offend anybody, but those measures are not sensitive at all.
Viger says the government also suggested video streaming, but he says the model doesn't work for the theater, where there are expenses like royalties to international companies. The government is now allowing some theaters in Mexico City to reopen, but with a limited audience capacity of up to 30%. Sergio Mayer was a producer, a telenovela actor, and became famous in the 80s singing in the bubblegum pop band Garibaldi.
Mexicana like it.
Now, Mayer is a member of Mexico's Congress and leads the Culture and Film Committee. He says his experience as a performer makes him more sensitive to the magnitude of the current problem. Mayer says creative industries represent $31 billion of economic activity per year, about 3.5% of Mexico's GDP.
Ese dinero que se recupere de las subastas.
Mayer says he's pushing a bill to help creative industries. It would allow the use of money from the government's auctions of artworks taken from people who couldn't make their tax payments. He says that money should be used to reactivate the culture and arts. But he says it's also a moment for the theater and entertainment industries to be resilient. And some in the industry are finding ways to do that. Adriana Biri is the technical director for one of the largest theater complexes in Mexico City.
We have to be optimistic, because if we're not optimistic, we're going to, drown.
Biri says one of the theater technicians she knows created prototype ventilators, adapting to the current crisis. And for her, that's an example to follow. But it's still not easy to transfer skills from theater to other fields.
We're suffering a lot, because it's not that if I don't work in the theater, I go and I work in another thing.
The technician says she knows people living off their savings. Some of her colleagues have died from COVID-19. Recently, she heard about a children's play in a parking lot that was successful. And for her, it shows that the theater is capable of adapting to these times.
The show must go on, and the show will go on.
Beatty says that the industry will grow stronger if people try to stick together and innovate. In Mexico City, I'm Rodrigo Cervantes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out. I have often thought that the U.S. was way behind in vending machine culture. We've gotten better. You can now get your Uniqlo coats and Best Buy headphones and makeup at the airport vending machines. And now, from the footwear company Keen, you can also get face masks.
The Portland-based company has rolled out 5 face mask vending machines worldwide, 3 in Portland proper. And I guess it's not that surprising to hear, given Portland, to hear that they include tie-dye and some feature the artwork of Jerry Garcia. But still, for those days when you forgot your mask or you lost it or you just want to look a little cooler, I mean, that is genius. And here's your bit of economic context for Friday. Business Insider has a chart on how our K-shaped recovery is playing out. The chart is also a handy definition of a term many of you heard first on Make Me Smart. High-wage industries lost the fewest jobs and have recovered the most. Low-wage industries lost the most jobs and are recovering the slowest. And that slow recovery is getting even slower. I know you've already heard this, but honestly, it never hurts to have another chart. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fregali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. And I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.